We're talking about how Wisconsin lawmakers and advocates are pushing for stricter drunken driving laws. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. One piece of legislation would require all OWI offenders, which stands for operating while intoxicated, to install these ignition interlock devices in their cars. The devices require the driver to pass a breath alcohol test before their vehicle will start. Do you have an ignition interlocking device in your car from driving under the influence? Do you think this will make a long-lasting difference, or are you just trying to get through it? Do you think that experiencing the reach of these devices to include first-time offenders is the right move here? We're at 800-642-1234. Democratic State Senator Chris Larson is from Milwaukee, representing the 7th Senate District. State Senator Larson, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate. Always happy to be on.
So let's step back here for a moment. What's the current law in Wisconsin on penalizing drunken drivers? Where are we right now?
Right now, first offense is a fine. They range from $150 to $300. You may take an alcohol treatment course, and a 6 to 9 month suspension of driver's license is possible. Ignition interlock devices are only required for if you refuse a sobriety field test, if you are a repeat offender, and if you blow a blood alcohol level of 0.15 or greater. But right now, essentially, if you break that down, it's essentially a fine equivalent to a moving violation. Most people don't do time for their first offense, and it is the lowest penalty of any state in the nation for drunk driving.
What do you think needs to change here?
Well, I think it's time that we take drunk driving seriously in the state of Wisconsin. We unfortunately have a drinking and driving culture, and I think we can just move to just have a drinking and planning ahead culture by making sure that there is a real consequence if a person is pulled over for drunk driving. Anybody who is convicted, first offense, second offense, you will have an ignition interlock device installed on your vehicle for 1 year. And that will make sure that there is a real consequence associated with serious behavior.
So under your proposal, the threshold for getting this interlock device would be lower than the current legal limit for an OWI in Wisconsin?
No, it'd be the same. Anybody who's convicted of drunk driving, so 0.08 blood alcohol or higher, which is the state standard for driving under the influence.
Why are you looking to these interlock devices as the next step in addressing drunk driving?
Well, simply put, they work. There's 32 other states who have already done this, and what they're shown to do is reduce recidivism significantly. And that's because there's a real consequence, right? Any single time that person gets into their car for a year, they're going to have to blow sober or the car won't start. And not only that, but every other person who gets in the car with them will think twice about the next time they go out drinking and how they're going to get home so they don't have to have this on their vehicle. This reduces recidivism 67%. And even in Wisconsin, with its limited use, since 2006, interlocks have stopped over 300,000 attempts to drive drunk with a blood alcohol of 0.08 or greater, so over the legal limit. So 2 points, it stops drunk drivers from getting on the road, and it also changes behavior from people to drunk drive in the first place.
We're talking with State Senator Chris Larson, a Democrat representing Wisconsin's 7th Senate District. You can join in. You have a line to the lawmaker at 800-642-1234. Were you ever affected by a drunk driver and think the zero tolerance is the right approach? What do you hope to see lawmakers do in this area of drunk driving? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Senator Larson, we've seen policy proposals come down the line to lawmakers over the sessions, over the years. Mm-hmm. Why is right now the right time to introduce this type of legislation?
Well, what's different now is this. I mean, this has been a serious problem for years. Wisconsin has some of the worst rates of drunk driving. But I think what's different is we actually have a governor this time around who has voiced support for actually acting on drunk driving first offenses. We have passed laws in the past. We have made some moves. Governor Walker signed making fourth offense a felony. But this is the first time we actually have a governor looking to sign and asking for legislation that will make first offense a real consequence. We've also seen a more drunk driving legislation introduced by more legislators on a bipartisan basis than I've seen in my 8 years in office. So there's five pieces, actually two were just introduced in the last week. So we're actually up to seven pieces of legislation circulating to tackle drunk driving. So it's getting to be bipartisan. It's getting to be past time that Wisconsin doesn't want to be the only state in the country where first offense is not a misdemeanor or higher.
So we're seeing traction in policymaking and legislation that is being put forth. What about advocates? What has the impact been from Mothers Against Drunk Driving, for instance?
I mean, we had a press conference yesterday, Kate, and just hearing the stories of neighbors who have been devastated by this. And because this is an issue I've been tackling, been hearing from folks for years, and it's frustrating because there are new advocates now that weren't there 4 or 5 years ago because they've been affected by this, because they've lost, in one case, a mother lost her only son. There's another one where on a recent trip, another mother lost her son to drunk driving, her first son. And these are people who are passionate about it. They are frustrated that the law hasn't changed. They're frustrated with the excuses. And they're acting. You know, they went door to door around the Capitol explaining why this is important and why this needs to get done. And frankly, when you weigh the impact of this against the excuses of why we haven't, it becomes pretty silly that we've waited this long. So I think that's going to, they're mad. And those who've been affected and those who've experienced this, them calling their legislators has been a game changer.
Let's bring in a call now. Let's go to Pete joining us from Oconomowoc. Pete, hi.
Hi. Yeah, so I just wanted to chime in because the idea of putting IIDs in people's cars, I think it's a great idea. The only problem is that currently, if somebody needs an IID in their car or any vehicle they have in their name, the courts currently exempt people from having to have it in more than one vehicle. So they have access to a vehicle potentially at their homes oftentimes because they own more than one vehicle that doesn't have an IID in it. So it's kind of smoke and mirrors in that it, you know, the law sounds good, but really doesn't have the teeth that it was intended.
Well, let's get Senator Larson to respond to that. Is that perhaps a loophole here?
Sure. I'm glad you brought that up because that was a loophole that we did correct recently. So any vehicle that's operated by somebody who's under court order to have an ignition and interlock device must have it on every vehicle that they drive. The penalty for not having that, for circumventing using a different vehicle, and I'm sure people will try that, and the law is going to get them. The first one, the fine ranges from $150 to $600 and or 6 months confinement. And it goes up from there for second or higher offenses. So, and I would say that for those who may try to circumvent the process by blowing into it, running their car, that old thing, the technology has caught up. So they're not able to do that anymore. There's a blow when you start. There's a blow while you're driving at intermittent points. So they'll have to stay sober. And if they're not, the vehicle will start blinking, the hazard lights go on, and the horn starts sounding until they pull over.
Talking with Democratic State Senator Chris Larson of Milwaukee about legislation to expand the use of interlock devices on cars that prevent drunk driving from starting their ignition. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We'll hear your thoughts in a moment on the Ideas Network. We're talking about ignition interlock devices and OWI penalties in Wisconsin. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Democratic lawmakers are proposing a bill that would require all first-time drunken drivers to use ignition interlock devices. Senator Chris Larson's bill would require judges to order first-timers to use ignition interlocks for a year regardless of blood alcohol level, and the option of going into a sobriety program would be eliminated. Do you currently have an ignition interlocking device in your car from driving under the influence? Do you think it will make a long-lasting difference, or are you just trying to get through it? You have a line at 800-642-1234. State Senator Chris Larson of Milwaukee stays with us. Let's go back to the phones now with Val joining us from Waukesha. Val, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My concern with this, and it's something that I've thought of for a long time, is helping more on the education side. I've never taken a breathalyzer and have only relied on how I feel after drinking to judge whether or not I should drive. I was wondering if anybody's ever proposed something like that the police would set up a breathalyzer station around bars, maybe downtown Milwaukee, that would have no repercussions for people who took it, but then people could see what their actual blood alcohol level was and make a better choice of, oh, that's how much I drank, this is how drunk I am, or to know that they shouldn't get in a car and drive.
Interesting. Senator Larson.
Yeah, I mean, that's a fantastic idea. I mean, the ground rule of what a .08 means is about one drink an hour. And so if you've had that, if you haven't had the time to sober up, it's going to affect you. But yeah, there used to be programs where they'd go bar to bar and give people the idea of what it meant. And I'm sure that they should do that again. Unfortunately, in some cases, it led to abuse, right, of some people trying to see how high they could get it. So there is that problem associated with it, too. But, yeah, I think that would be a good idea. If it's administered by police, they'd probably be less likely to try and screw around with it.
Senator Larson, what does intoxicated driving look like in Wisconsin? What are the numbers here? What do we know?
Well, the last numbers we have for Wisconsin are 2017, 179 deaths in Wisconsin due to OWI crashes. We also had in that same year 6,151 total traffic accidents with alcohol being a factor, which is kind of a stunning total. This is on top of the overall numbers of what we have in terms of first-time offenders and repeat offenders topping over 10,000 across the state. So this is, this is nationwide the last year. For 2016, there was 10,497 deaths. So this is an impact. This is something that's affecting people, and these are all preventable deaths.
Let's go to Matt now, joining us from Menominee. Hi, Matt.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning. Go ahead.
So the reason I called in is I've got immediate family or close family that's been through the incidents and had OWIs or DWIs, was just tried in Dunn County and convicted of his 10th. And in that case, was given 4 years, which, according to everything I could find out, is the minimum for the 10th OWI. So I don't know if it is strictly a legislative issue or a judicial issue as well, which, I mean, is a compounding factor. We're not really using the laws we have to correct actions that people are taking with the laws.
Matt, thank you for bringing this up. What do we know, Senator Larson, how legislation works and parlays into what judges order in the judicial process?
Yeah, I mean, there is a formula that they work through, and we have tightened the laws to try and make sure that there is more severe penalties available for repeat offenders. In a lot of those cases, what you're dealing with is abuse, and people are much further down the road of abuse when they get to something as stunning as, a 10th offense. And if you back it up, if we're not shifting the culture early on, you're going to have a lot more of that. Right now, it's estimated that people have driven under the influence 80 times before they're pulled over that first time in Wisconsin. And so what that says is people are not taking the penalty associated with it seriously. And right now, when they get that first offense, because it's simply a ticket, doesn't require them to show up in court at all. They can just pay the fine. There's not necessarily that real consequence up front. And so people are on that path much earlier, and we have to circumvent that before they even get to that first offense.
I understand that these interlock devices can be expensive. There are installation fees, monthly fees, a removal fee, and that people who are at or below 150% of the federal poverty line are eligible to pay discounted fees. What is the process like there, especially for low-income people?
Yeah, so this would be for, I mean, you outlined it very well, Kate. So essentially the costs are $75 to $150 for installation, $60 to $90 for the monthly fee, and another $40 to $60 to remove it. And for those who have economic hardship and can prove that they're below 150% of the federal level of poverty, they would have it at half price. So they'd have a discounted fee that they would have to pay. And so all of this is paid for by those who are guilty, by those who are convicted guilty in this. So the cost to taxpayers of the installation, of the maintenance, is covered entirely by those who are convicted. So for those who are in economic hardship, yes, it could be a little bit more, but, you know, this is a way to make sure that there's a serious consequence associated with drunk driving. People shouldn't be drunk driving.
Talking with State Senator Chris Larson, a Democrat representing Wisconsin's 7th Senate District. Let's go back to the phones now with Peter joining us from Madison. Peter, what are your thoughts here?
I don't think that first-time OWI should be a criminal offense. I think you run into situations where people are just barely over the legal limit and get pulled over for a broken taillight, and then they all of a sudden they have a criminal record now when they were otherwise a responsible driver. I think that the interlock device is a good idea. The only problem I see with the interlock device is the enforcement mechanism. It's very difficult to enforce. The person can drive a different vehicle. I think the better way to enforce that would be to impound the vehicle, and that if a person who has multiple DWIs is pulled over and their car does not have an interlock device to impound that vehicle, the overwhelming majority of the fatal accidents are caused by people who are habitual offenders who are perpetually driving drunk, and they're not really going to follow the laws when it comes to the interlock device.
Senator Larson, what about impounding vehicles?
Yeah, I mean, I think for the most part, given the sheer numbers that we have at this point of people who are convicted of drunk driving, I've signed on to a bill to make first offense a misdemeanor. And I think that ignition interlock devices work in actually shifting people's behavior while still being able to carry on with their lives, right? Of still being able to get to work, of still being able to get to school. If you take away somebody's vehicle, you're taking away their livelihood. And while it may solve the immediate problem of not having that person drink and drive, you're creating a whole slew of problems because you're condemning a person to poverty or on the road to poverty, essentially. So I think this one, the IID for all offenses, all convictions, is to make sure that there is a consequence, that a person can still carry on with their life as they learn that drinking and driving is not something they will ever repeat. And anybody who gets in that car will also recognize that consequence, too. And as I mentioned earlier, Kate, there is that consequence for those who try and circumvent it. Sure, there's going to be those people. You get caught doing that, then yes, you are going to pay a higher fine, and you're probably going to go to jail.
So as you see some of these bills, this legislation coming out in regards to drunk driving, do you see compromise here between Democrats and Republicans? Are you willing to compromise on your legislation?
Yeah, actually we have. And I think that's the most comforting thing, Kate, is we had I've introduced this for 8 years, and this is the first year it's actually had bipartisan support. There are 5 bills that have already been introduced and are up in committees, available to be scheduled for public hearing. And of those 5, 4 of them have bipartisan support, which is pretty tremendous. And we had a press conference yesterday. It was, it was odd because it was the first, I think one of the first times I've been at a press conference where you had a mix of both Democrats and Republicans speaking, who normally we don't agree on a lot of issues on partisan lines, but this is one where we have to get it done. you know, we have to get it done. A drunk driver is going to affect a person, whether they're a Democrat or Republican. So we have to do something about this.
Really quick, as we wrap up here, there's some research out there that says once these interlock devices are removed, recidivism rates return back to where they were. Are there any steps that should be taken after the year is up and the interlock comes off?
Yeah, I haven't seen that. What I've seen is that it reduces recidivism 67%. And so I'm not sure of the long term, but I know that there's putting these in there does have that impact of making sure that people are going to have to shift their behavior. And of course, if there is somebody who repeats, the penalties get more severe as they repeat penalties.
Well, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, you bet. Anytime. Thank you, Kate.
Democratic State Senator Chris Larson is from Milwaukee, representing the 7th Senate District. We've been talking about his bill that would require all first-time drunk drivers to use ignition interlock devices. Coming up, it's news, then sound off. Should college student athletes be paid? And how do you quantify the true worth of a college sports team? We're at 800-642-1234. Stay with us. It's March Madness on the Ideas Network. We're talking about whether college student athletes should be paid. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. No doubt you could make the case that being a college student athlete is a full-time job between the weight room, the court or field, the classroom, and then rising to the level of NCAA competition. March Madness is underway. It's big business. Networks raked in $1.3 billion in March Madness ad revenue last year. Do you think college athletes should receive some kind of compensation, whether it's a paycheck or an endorsement deal, or should the NCAA's amateurism model remain? We're at 800-642-1234 for you to weigh in. Ken Reed is sports policy director for League of Fans. That's a sports reform project. He's also a columnist and author. His latest book is called The Sports Reformers, Working to Make the World of Sports a Better Place. Ken, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, thanks, Kate. Glad to be here.
Here we are, another year, another March Madness. And once again, talking about the issue of college athlete competition. So with all the money flowing into events like the NCAA and March Madness, do you hear the calls for paying players getting louder and louder?
Well, definitely, and I think the recent injury to Duke star player Zion Williamson kind of highlighted the situation. He blew out his Nike sneaker just playing. It ripped out, and he sprained his knee in the process and had to sit out 5 or 6 games. And he's going to be the number one pick in the NBA draft. He fortunately is back, and he's going to play in the tournament, but he was very close to possibly ripping up his knee, torn ACL or something, and his market value plummeting dramatically. So I think that the situation is it's just an untenable system at its roots, this idea of amateurism when everyone else is making millions and billions of dollars, and the people, the producers that are creating the product, just are being unfairly compensated.
Well, let's talk Zion here for a moment, because I mean, here you have a player with a huge following, like a once in a generation player, larger than life. He's got, you know, the pick. He can go out his doorstep and basically be the first pick for the NBA, millions of dollars standing right there. How do you exercise any self-control there? And you know that playing on Duke, you're going to be bringing in lots of money for the NCAA.
Well, yes, it seems strange and very unfair to me that Coach K, Duke's head coach, is making $5, $6, $7, $8 million, not sure what it is these days, and Zion gets a seat in a classroom and gets a scholarship and room and board paid for when his market value is multi-million. So I'm not downgrading the value of a college education. It's very worthy and worthwhile, but it's so far from what his true market value would be. And just the unfairness of broadcasters, coaches, ad execs, school athletic directors, everyone's getting a piece of this NCAA pie, except the people that put on the exciting product.
So the argument against athlete compensation is that many of these athletes already receive scholarships, their tuition paid for, perhaps some small financial stipends. Is that enough?
Well, no, like I just mentioned, I think there's value in that, obviously, but it's just not related to their true marketplace compensation. And I think the whole idea of paying college athletes is indeed complicated. I admit that. I mean, you'd have to deal with how do schools put players on the payroll? Is there worker compensation issues, Title IX issues, the whole gamut? So I think the clear, obvious, and simple first step is just to move from the current system to the Olympic model, where Olympic athletes not that long ago were considered amateurs and not allowed to take any compensation whatsoever. That was changed so that they can now get compensation on endorsement deals and get compensated for their names, likenesses, and images, just like most Americans can. And so it's a way of players like Zion Williamson getting compensated without actually having them on the Duke payroll. Someone wants to pay Zion $2 million to have his face on a calendar or a jersey, or even, you know, come down for $50,000 at the local auto parts store to sign your autograph, sign autographs for a couple hours, that he would be allowed to do that. And that wouldn't affect the athletic department in terms of payroll or anything like that. It would just be a way for especially the superstars to get closer to what their true value is. There's a study done that Zion Williamson's shoe deal, if he was allowed to take one for Nike or anyone else, would be at least $10.5 million a year.
Mm. Talking with Ken Reed, sports policy director for League of Fans. Listeners, what do you think? Should college athletes be able to receive compensation? And if so, where should it come from? You can weigh in at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Ken, as I understand it, the state of California is considering some legislation that would loosen up the rules for amateur athletes in the state. What are lawmakers considering there?
Well, it's Senate Bill 206 in California, and they call it the Fair Pay to Play Act in the California State Legislature. But under this bill, college athletes would be allowed to receive compensation in a way that's very similar to what Olympic athletes can receive, basically endorsement deals or any other type of compensation that comes from sources outside the athletic department itself.
Is California the first state to consider something like this?
The first one that I know of. I mean, there's been plenty of talk, but in terms of actually having a bill that's up for review, that's the first one that I've seen.
Well, Pete from Reedsburg says the pay issue, as well as the many scandals in recent years, make it painfully obvious that the missions of our higher learning institutions and big-time college athletics are inherently incompatible. They should be separated. Let the NBA and NFL create and pay for their own player development leagues. What do you make of that?
Well, I couldn't agree more. I mean, the original problem was that we tied big-time entertainment sports to our institutions of higher learning. When you go over to Europe, they don't have anything like Duke versus North Carolina in basketball or Texas versus Oklahoma in football. The universities there are for academic endeavors, and then the elite athletes go to clubs and play in, you know, high-level club soccer or basketball or whatever the case might be. So that was the original mistake we made in this country, is tying big-time sports to academic institutions. But that's not going to change anytime soon. So I think we have to address the situation of here we have a product that is very popular and financially lucrative, and everyone's making money off it except the athletes themselves.
Let's go to Deanne now, joining us from Eau Claire. Hi, Deanne. What are your thoughts?
Hi. I agree with the caller. You know, I think we can't keep tying the playing sports and education together and then compensating for them at the college level. But why can't we take some of the money that all these companies are earning and put it in retirement for the players that are helping them make the money? So they are being compensated in the long run, but not immediately, or we're going to end up with a bunch of kids that think they can just go to college to become a professional sports player rather than earn a degree.
So put it in piggy banks for the long road ahead.
Ken, yes.
Ken, what do you make of that?
I think that's a good idea. I'd have to see how it would be organized, but I think there's a way to establish accounts for these student athletes that once they complete a year or 2 years or get a diploma, that then they can receive the money. They wouldn't receive it directly while they're in school, but they could receive it afterwards. It would definitely be a much better system than today. Now,
let's bring in Steve joining us from Sun Prairie. Steve, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, the question I have is, it's so obvious these athletes are the employees of the university. They, at their beck and call, they have to follow their work rules. What specifically in the law prevents the DOL from coming in and saying, you guys have to treat these people like employees? If there was a business that didn't pay their employees and only paid them a tuition, the DOL would be all over that. So
looking at labor laws, what are the labor laws here is what Steve is wondering.
Well, what was kind of a shrewd thing to do by the NCAA 30, 40, 50 years ago was to create this term student athlete. And once they did that, they got away around a lot of the labor laws because they classified them as students just like any other student, a band member or any other student on campus. If the focus is on that they're students under these universities, which are nonprofit entities, which is kind of humorous in itself, that an athletic department like Michigan that sells out 100,000 plus every week for football is considered a nonprofit, but that's how they are in our tax codes. But as long as the term student athlete survives, then that's kind of been their defense to this point.
Well, put them, let's walk in their shoes. They're often having to do long hours, long plane rides, heading out of town on a Wednesday, trying to keep up with schoolwork, back on a Sunday, back to classes Monday, and the weight room. And, I mean, it sounds like the athlete part would certainly be getting in the way of the student part.
Well, definitely. I mean, there are studies that show these students are putting well over 40 hours a week into their sport activity. So it makes you truly admire the athletes that are able to be full-time students and do well in the classroom while still basically doing this full-time plus job. It's pretty amazing that some of them can pull it off, but for a lot of them, they fall well short and they don't take enough classes to actually graduate on time. And it's basically universities using them to make a lot of money. There's even a worse problem that's not talked about that often is sometimes these athletes get injured while playing for their school, end up losing their scholarship. And while they might have the initial surgery, any follow-up health concerns or issues related to the injury that they was sustained while they were playing aren't covered. And these athletes are basically left on their own. That's one first step that needs to be taken care of to make this more fair.
March Madness is underway. It got us thinking about the debate over whether college student athletes should be paid or not. You can weigh in at 800-642-1234. We'll pick this discussion up in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're looking at the issue of whether college student athletes should be paid. You're with us on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Talking about compensation in light of the NCAA Division I men's basketball tournament that's underway. Ticket sales for this year's 68 games are expected to add around $160 million to the NCAA's coffers. Four networks together paid the NCAA $10.8 billion in 2011 for a 14-year contract to broadcast the tournament. And that contract was extended until 2032. Another payment, $8.8 billion. You can weigh in at 800-642-1234. Do you think college athletes should receive some kind of compensation or not? Ken Reed is with us. He is sports policy director for League of Fans. Ken, there's been some pushback. At a recent event, former NBA star Charles Barkley was asked about compensation for college athletes. And here's a bit of what he had to say.
I've heard these idiots say, well, why don't we let God sell their likeness? Yeah, that's great if you're a star. Listen, let me tell you something. If I'm a big fat offensive lineman and the quarterback is selling his jersey and he's getting commercials and the running back and I'm actually doing all the work, how do you think that's going to go over in the locker room?
How do you think that's going to go over in the locker room when the quarterback is getting all the glory and the offensive lineman is doing all of the heavy lifting? What do you make of that argument?
Well, it makes a lot of sense. I wouldn't probably be that excited if I was that offensive lineman either, but it's the reality in our marketplace that some employees are more valuable than others. I mean, look at the NFL. The quarterbacks are making multi-million dollars and the linemen are making several hundred thousand dollars to block for them. So it's not an unusual situation in terms of any profession, whether it's football, sports, or any other industry. I think one of the things I'd like to touch on here is we mentioned Zion Williamson, the superstar at Duke, and he might get a shoe contract for $10.5 million or something. This kind of gets to Barkley's point too, but there was a study done at Drexel University, and this looks at what fair market value would be at the University of Texas, and this is for the 2011-2012 school year, so quite a while back. But the study found that the average or the true market value of just an average football player at Texas would be $567,922 annually. There's plenty to go around. The Texas football team that year generated $103 million in revenue. The cost of their scholarships was $1.8 million. So $103 million in revenue, $1.8 million in scholarships. That leaves a lot of money left to that could potentially be given to athletes. And just a couple days ago, a minor, relatively minor conference, the American Athletic Conference, not one of the Power Five conferences that you hear about, struck a deal with ESPN for $1 billion for 12 years for media rights. Mm. That's the American Athletic Conference. That school's like Central Florida, South Florida, East Carolina. So not exactly the Big Ten or the ACC or the SEC.
And
they're going to get about $7 million per school.
Well, Ken, riddle me this. You know, we're talking about the heavy hitters here, football and basketball. What about athletes in other more low-profile sports? What do you do there?
Well, that's a good point.
And women's sports.
That's why the Olympic model would be an easier first step. I don't think it's the complete solution. But if you start putting athletes on payroll, then you have Title IX to deal with in terms of equity between the genders. It affects, you know, the female athletes as well. As I wrote in a recent column, superstar swimmer Missy Franklin, who was a four-time gold medalist, wanted to have the college experience, and she enrolled at Cal Berkeley to swim for them, turning down lucrative professional offers, and because of the amateur system in place in college, she couldn't take any endorsement deals or anything. She ended up hurting her shoulder, never being able to recover back to her elite level, and the offers that she had before she went to Cal disappeared, and so she was hurt by the system as well.
Let's go to Jeff in Wrightstown. Jeff, hi.
Hi there. First of all, NFL offensive linemen make millions, not several hundred thousand dollars. In this argument to pay college athletes, you're using Zion, who is in the vast, vast minority of college student athletes. And the scholarships are paying a lot more for students who are getting a college education that's worth far more than what they bring to the table. Now, the millions of dollars that come to the university, now that money goes to help pay for the programs that don't generate income. So if you want to spend all that money that comes in, then be willing to kiss goodbye to baseball, the women's basketball, and the programs that don't generate money.
So really, we're looking at the exceptions here, Ken Reed, and we've got to keep in mind Title IX.
Well, for one thing, I don't think football and basketball players should have to pay for swimmers and golfers to go to college. And second, there's every other student on campus, whether, say, you're on a music scholarship and you're getting your tuition paid, but you can play in a band on the weekend at the local club and they'll pay you for that and you can keep that money. but athletes can't take any money outside of their scholarship. So it's just unfair. It's a situation that's different than every other student on campus. And to his point about Zion Williamson, sure, not everyone's going to get a $10 million shoe contract, but as I mentioned in the study by Drexel, just an average football player at Texas in 2011-2012 was worth $567,000 if it was on peer market-based economics.
Let's bring in Stephanie in Madison now. Hi, Stephanie.
Good morning. I absolutely do not think that student athletes need to be paid. They have a huge privilege to be playing at that level and receiving free free tuition and, other scholarships. Oftentimes they pay other students to do their work, and, they're getting out without any debt, which is something that, is a huge value to kids our age these days.
So Stephanie brings the point that they are not going to be burdened with debt on the other end of their education.
Well, sure, but if you were making $500,000 or $1 million a year, you wouldn't be too burdened either. Now, like I mentioned many times, there's value obviously in a scholarship, but it's a capped compensation system that limits their true value of what they should be getting paid, or at least the opportunity to get paid.
Well, Ken, look into your crystal ball here. Going forward, do you expect the NCAA to hold on to this amateurism model as long as they can? What are they feeling here? What do we know?
Well, I don't think it's going to last that much longer. I mean, look at the Olympics. It blew up, and they couldn't make these athletes be true amateurs anymore. They finally allowed them to be compensated for their names, images, and likenesses. And I think the same thing is going to happen with colleges. It's just a matter of time. You see more things like the bill we brought up in California, the Fair Pay to Play Act. And the more that people realize that the millions and billions of dollars that are in college athletics and how small a proportion that goes to the actual producers of that product, I think eventually it'll just be a groundswell of we got to treat these people more fairly than they are being treated.
And in light of this huge college admissions scandal, some very wealthy parents have been implicated in efforts to basically buy spots for their children at elite schools. This has entangled, bribing college coaches and creating fake athletic profiles. What do you think needs to be the NCAA reaction?
Well, I think that's a pretty separate issue in terms of the only reason there's athletics involved in that bribery scandal with celebrities and wealthy people for these colleges is because they try to enhance their students' profile by saying they're an athlete, which a lot of these Ivy schools and Stanfords, et cetera, love seeing that kids that are athletic apply to their schools. And so they make up fake profiles. None of these kids are actually legitimate athletes. It's just a way to game the system. So I think that's different than how true college athletes are being compensated.
Ken, thank you for joining us.
Sure. I enjoyed it. It's a important discussion. I think one year we might see Duke or North Carolina team actually boycott or strike and not play, and CBS would obviously go crazy about that, and things would happen a lot quicker. But it's hard to organize.
Our brackets would all disappear. Ken Reed, Sports Policy Director for League of Fans Sports Reform Project. Just ahead, we talk about living to 100. No easy feat. We'll find out what these centenarians have on their mind. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.